It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Everybody to the show live on Sundays here on News Talk WSB. So glad you could join us today. First, make sure you're following me on Twitter. It's at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. We tweet during the show, and if you're not on Twitter, you're missing half the conversation, hands down. I also want you to go to thinkglink.com, which is my website, and sign up for my free weekly newsletter, because that's where we push out all of the content we work on in a given week. So if you want great information about buying, selling, fixing up, financing your house, and all the other cool stuff that goes along with it, thinkglink.com. And we've got new videos up at our YouTube channel, Expert Real Estate Tips. So loads going on in the ThinkGlink community. Today I have brought together some of my very good friends in the world of health and media. We're going to talk today, start out with Bruce Javson, longtime friend. He's a former longtime healthcare reporter, business reporter. He currently writes a blog for Forbes and the New York Times, and he's also writing for and on the editorial board for the Medicare News Group, near and dear to my heart. And I asked him, welcome, Bruce. You with us?
Yeah, great to be here, Elise. Good to be on.
It's so good to have you. Here we are right in front of the election. And, you know, once Paul Ryan was named vice presidential candidate, I thought, wow, Medicare is now front and center, and there's so much stuff going back and forth. I just thought you were the perfect person to have an eye on what's going on and sort of fill us in a little bit on where Medicare stands right now, because we're hearing all kinds of sound bites, as we like to call them on the Medicare News Group. Not really sure what's true, what's not true, but I thought you would be able to divine the truth.
Well, I'll do the best that I can. I mean, definitely, Elise, the Medicare issue is huge, and perhaps it is the most important issue for seniors, and they will be able to choose at the ballot box what appears to be, you know, fundamental differences in how Medicare will be carried out, and they talk about that. But there are also a lot of similarities, too, and I can get into that. But first, I wanted to say that, you know, generally, seniors who have traditional Medicare, nothing is going to change right away, despite the fact that, you know, Paul Ryan has a plan which would eventually, perhaps if it ever passed Congress, would give people, perhaps when you and I are ready for Medicare, a voucher, a coupon, if you will, to go to buy a plan on the private sector. None of that is going to happen right away, even if Romney and Ryan win the election and get something passed through Congress. Now, President Obama and generally the Democratic plan is to keep traditional Medicare as it is, where, you know, seniors get access. It's a defined benefit plan, and generally you have to go out and maybe buy a supplemental policy, or you go into a so-called Medicare Advantage plan, which is basically a private health plan that contracts with Medicare to provide benefits and maybe a little extras that are not in traditional Medicare.
Right. Let me just jump in and say there's always this misconception between how much Medicare costs, and you see it in the media all the time, Medicare versus Medicare Advantage, but really it's an unfair comparison.
It is a little unfair comparison. I mean, I think that Medicare Advantage plans, it's going to be kind of invisible to the senior, okay? I mean, they are going to get, Medicare Advantage plans have been around for a long time, whether they're called Medicare Advantage or Medicare HMO or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, United Healthcare has one, Humana has them, Aetna has them, a lot of Blue Cross plans have them. So it can be very confusing. So we'll try to keep it as simple as possible in saying that to the seniors out there, the costs are not a lot different. Now, when you're talking about the taxpayer and Congress deciding what they're going to pay for when we have no money,
mm-hmm.
There have been studies that show that the Medicare Advantage plans might get a little more in some instances because they have higher administrative costs. Now, I would say that the whole thing that everybody is moving toward is that, okay, you know, there are even, you might even in the future, doctors, primary care doctors, internists, family physicians, such, might get paid more or a higher rate to do something, but the whole idea is to keep people out of the hospital, keep them healthy, give them wellness visits, all that type of stuff. So these cost numbers get thrown around, and I would like to think that everybody has good intentions, but when you talk about, you know, it can get confusing to people. So going forward, what's really interesting here is this. President Obama has bought into the private health plan idea that Paul Ryan is talking about. That might be news to people. Okay, there are Medicare Advantage plans. Just this week, they were out.
Is Paul Ryan talking about Medicare Advantage plans when he talks about? Is that what he really means?
Well, he's talking about. He talks about something that's a little bit complicated called premium support. You know, Paul Ryan should talk about it. I mean, it would be a heck of a lot simpler. He's kind of a policy wonk, and I kind of wonder if he, you know, some of these guys can't really talk to the average person on how this is. But they're talking about, you know, a premium support, which is a fancy way to say they want private health plans. The Republicans would say, we want private health plans to do it because we think we can do it better than the government. But even in the Romney-Ryan plan, traditional Medicare, people could stay in traditional Medicare. Okay.
So let me just sort of go back to premium support for a minute. So my takeaway from premium support is it's a little bit like premiums that you would pay for private insurance plans, right? But they'll give you, let's say, $10,000 a person or $5,000 or $5,200, whatever the number is, and you pay everything above that. Is that not the takeaway?
It could be, yes.
It could
definitely be. And you know what? That is starting to emerge in the commercially insured sector already, and I can get into that in a minute. And so, but basically you have two different approaches, and they're really not all that far apart because the Obama administration has carried on something from the Bush administration where they have been supportive of Medicare Advantage, which are private health plans contracted with the government. They've touted this. They've said, hey, you know what? We're going to let these things stay in. We're going to cut some money from what we give them to provide benefits, but they just came out with new quality ratings. So seniors can go on Medicare.gov, and they can see whether plan A, B, or C has a 5-star rating, or a 4-star rating, or a 3-star rating, or a 2-star rating, or a 1-star rating. If they have a 4 or 5-star rating, a senior might say, hey, I might check that out, depending on what it costs me. And you know what? Next year, they get bonus payments from the government to provide seniors care. So even though there was a cut under the Affordable Care Act, which Romney and Ryan will talk about, saying you guys are cutting Medicare benefits, the Obama administration would say under the Health Care Act, or what they should say, but often don't, is that we're cutting money from these plans because we think they get paid too much administrative costs. But you know what? They can get more money on the back end if they hit these 4 and 5 stars.
So it's interesting that, you know, the plans, you don't think the plans are that different, and yet they're portrayed in the media as being just sort of vastly, vastly different. And I imagine that's to garner votes on one side or the other. But it is interesting to see that there's a lot more similarities than...
Well, I can tell you the difference, so as for the cost. If we were to go down the road of the Romney-Ryan PAM plan with the voucher or the coupon, okay, and it's $10,000 a senior, does anybody really think that once that you as a senior get $10,000 that they're going to get you $10,500 the next year and $11,000?
No, that's the problem we're having now, is that it's always spiraling up.
It spirals up for you and I because we're under 65. It doesn't spiral.
Oh, please.
Up.
I just can't. I can't even discuss how much I pay now for health care insurance. I just
But it doesn't cost. It's not costing the seniors more. I mean, a little bit more out of their, you know, check or their Social Security or whatever. But it's not. They don't really know what the real cost is. And that's what the private sector is moving to. And I was going to get back to this coupon idea. So what Obama and company and the Democrats would say is that they say, listen, you know, you can't just give these doddering old seniors, I apologize to your senior listeners, I'm just using a phrase here, you cannot give these old folks a coupon and tell them to go out and buy a health insurance, you know, it would be confusing to them and they can't do it. You know, okay, so that's one thing. And they also say if the Romney-Ryan plan, keeps traditional Medicare, they believe that the private insurance companies would have bad intentions, and they would go and they would try to sign up healthy seniors, and the sick seniors would be left in the traditional Medicare system, which means the cost would go up faster. That has happened. There's been instances where that's happened in the past, but that's a leap of faith, you know, depending on how things would be regulated.
I got to tell you, Bruce, I mean, if you're on a fixed income, and thanks to the fact that interest rates are zero, seniors who have depended on fixed income securities are earning Zippo on their money. So they're using up their money faster than they expected.
Right.
Social Security is a concern, and it doesn't provide, I mean, it's subsistence, right? It gives you enough to basically put food on the table and whatever, but nobody's getting rich off of Social Security. So when it comes to Medicare, the idea that you're going to get some sort of fixed amount and anything else is up to you,
yep,
it just seems like a recipe for disaster. And if that is the premium support plan, I'm not sure that really works. On the other side, we're driving into a brick wall at 60 miles an hour, and every single CEO of a healthcare company that I've spoken to in the last 2 years, and it's been quite a few, all have said the same thing, that we're moving into a brick wall at 60 miles an hour, and nobody even realizes how bad it is. Because exponentially, you know, 2 to the 2 power, right, is 4, but pretty soon you're at 128 to the 128th power, and that's unaffordable. And I think neither plan really addresses that.
Well, I'm going to get, that's a great point you brought up about CEOs, okay? We all know Sears. We all don't go to Sears anymore. Sears is a chain that's having trouble, okay? But Sears is out there. But Sears having issues with healthcare costs like everybody else. Sears just went, and this is written up in the Wall Street Journal and on the Bruce Japson Forbes healthcare blog, Sears is going to a plan they worked out with Aon and Hewitt, big benefits companies, where they're saying to their employees, here's a coupon, here's a voucher, here's a defined amount of money we're going to give you. Go to this exchange set up by Aon where there are several health plans participating. Buy your own health care. So that is the Paul Ryan plan in the private sector. It's going on now. And
well,
so,
that's the exchanges that they keep talking about. They want the states to set up similar exchanges, and that's what they would look like.
Exactly. And so I think if I were to throw Congressman Ryan a rope here, I would say to him, okay, be a little bit clear and say, my plan isn't going to change Medicare now, but for folks my age in their 40s and 50s, when they get to Medicare, they're already going to be used to this type of a system. It's going on at Sears. It's going on at a couple of other companies. Companies can't afford this anymore, and so some people would say they are throwing their employees to the whims of shopping. But you know what? Shopping, it's going to have to change. I mean, the people at Aon and Hewitt and Sears would say, hey, listen, you're already doing it now at Orbitz when you buy your plane tickets, or Amazon.com when you buy your books or your shop for...
That is such a good point that you actually bring up, that is how we already shop for airline tickets. We're all conditioned to that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You go on and you see who's doing what, and if you go at 6 in the morning and you come back at 11 at night, it's cheaper than if you go at 4 in the afternoon and come back at 10 in the morning.
Yeah.
So there is this sort of really interesting relationship set up, and if exchanges make that clear, not that buying health insurance is at all anyway as simple and simple as buying an airplane ticket, but
right,
it seems
we're not
like,
there yet. That's the two.
Yeah,
right? We're not there yet. We have to get there, and I think that, and I don't necessarily even think that President Obama and the Democrats would be opposed to this. But what they're pushing is for more transparency, make the health plans, you know, achieve measures and quality ratings and all that other stuff. And they're not going to say it, but they might say, well, you know, down the road, you know, once we get, you know, the ability to shop for health care online and people mm-hmm. have their coupon or their voucher. And
there's so much more that you can do.
Yeah, but we're just not there yet, and I think the approaches are scary to people because, you know,
Because I want my Advil. I'm scared because I want my Advil.
Right.
All right, Bruce Japson is a longtime healthcare business reporter, and Bruce, honestly, I don't know why we don't have you on once a month. We're going to have to
do this.
We're going to have you on more quickly, but in the meantime, go to blogs.forbes.com. Bruce Japson is there. He also writes for the New York Times, and he is on the editorial board of the Medicare News Group, which is the place to go to get a look at all the issues and news going on in Medicare, medicarenewsgroup.com, where you will find Bruce and me and a whole bunch of other people. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I appreciate it. You can also find Bruce on Twitter at Bruce Japsen, BRUCEJAPSEN. We're going to put it all up on today's ThinkLink blog. I'm Elise Klink. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a flash with more on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at ThinkLink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to the Elise Klink Show, live on Sundays here, 11 to 1. Well, actually, 12 to 2. It's still football season on News Talk WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. We live tweet during these shows. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, and if you're not following me, you are missing half the conversation. It's time for Real Estate Insight with Rhonda Duffy. Rhonda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Glad to have you. So this week, I wanted to talk a little bit about what people are seeing online. So many people, more than 90% of everybody starts their search for a home online, and they're looking at pictures, and it seems to me that that's just fraught with danger. What do you think about all of these photos and how people should read them when they go online to look for a house?
Well, you're absolutely right. The dangers of looking online are so dangerous to a buyer's actual availability of properties to buy. Okay, so what they do, and all the buyers out there can shake their head, yes, this is what we do, because it's actually 97% now, and they search all the way up until closing to see if something better has come on the market. So it's kind of scary. It's good for a buyer. But here's what they do. They skim down the page, looking at the front photo, looking at the front. Oh, here's one. We'll look inside. Okay, I don't like their stuff. And, you know, I recently did a case study, which, of course, I'm going to post on my blog, rhondaduffy.com. And the case study showed a house that was on the market, and then it was staged. And it was dramatically different. And yet all the buyers that we surveyed said, oh, my gosh, of course I would go for this one, okay? So I think the danger is that they start as a buyer eliminating properties that really should be considered for the bones of what they have to offer. So I would recommend, instead of shortening your list with your calculated, okay, this is on, this is off, by looking at photos, I would say see everything in the market. Because whereas the Internet can be used as a tool, it can also be a dangerous weapon against your choice.
I think that's a great suggestion. I hope on your blog this week you're going to actually list out, because I can imagine 10 or 15 things you'd want to avoid or be aware of when you're looking at these pictures online, how images really don't necessarily reflect reality. So will you do that?
Yes, definitely. My mother has her own story, and I'll put it out there. RhondaDuffy.com.
I'm going to go there and read it. RhondaDuffy.com. Real Estate Insight is brought to you by Duffy Realty of Atlanta, and you can get more information at RhondaDuffy.com. Rhonda, thanks so much. We'll talk to you again next week.
See you next week.
All right. I'm Elise Klink. Stay tuned. We will be back in a flash with more of the Elise Klink Show on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at ThinkGlink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. We're here on Sundays at noon to 2 because it's football season on News Talk WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter at thinkglink.com. And don't forget to check out the Equifax Finance blog, which is an amazing place to get great free information about your personal finances and how credit relates to your personal finances. And to that end, I've actually invited onto the show today Jeff Rose. He is a financial advisor. He started out at AG Edwards, and he has done all sorts of things. In 2007, he formed the Alliance Investment Planning Group, and then he created a registry, a registered investment advisory, Alliance Wealth Management. And so we have him on the Equifax Finance blog to talk about retirement and money, and he's been blogging there for at least... Jeff, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How long have you been blogging for Equifax? It's a year now, isn't it?
Over a year, I believe.
Oh, my God. Time is flying.
Yeah.
He's in the retirement category, and you've also been blogging on your website, which is called Good Financial Sense, C-E-N-T-S, right?
Yes, ma'am. spam for about 4 years now, over 4 years.
GoodFinancialSense.com, and he's working on a book called Soldier of Finance, which you told me is that you're hoping people will have encouragement and discipline that they need to take back their lives financially.
Agreed. Absolutely.
That sounds good. Well, I love all the different things that you do, obviously, because we have you on the Equifax Finance blog. And I love that you sort of pick these different topics and kind of dig in. Now, I know you wanted to talk about 20 and 30-somethings today, subject near and dear to my heart. And you know as well as I do that with the Great Recession we've just had and for a big part of the country still have, people in their 20s came out of school with big debt and no jobs. And this is starting to change how this whole generation interacts. And what are you seeing in terms of retirement? Because when you're in your 20s without getting a job, boy, retirement's got to just seem impossible to achieve.
I agree. And I think a lot of it, too, is just that, you know, young people, they don't know, and which is almost so surprising nowadays of the wealth of information that's online that, you know, they just don't know how to get started, whether they should save for the 401k or they should open a Roth IRA or, you know, what a mutual fund even is. And I think it's that lack of information that just prevents them from taking that initial first step.
So when you talk to people in their 20s and 30s, is that your group that you mostly focus on with your practice, or are you looking at their parents instead?
You know, ironically, so like with my practice, I tend to work more with the parents, although I do have, you know, coming from the Gen X generation, I do have a lot of, you know, clients my age. But I know on my blog, I cover all topics, but I definitely have a wide base of the Gen X and Y generation.
So when you talk to parents of younger people, how are you encouraging them to open those lines of communication? And then when you talk to people who are in their 20s and 30s, how do you wake them up?
You know, it's funny because you can try to get the parents to educate their children, but the reality is, you know, as I know when I was a child, I didn't listen to my parents, you know. So, I mean, I could sit here and try to train the parents all day long, but it's not going to be passed on because it's going to fall upon deaf ears.
I see.
You know, so I think what, you know, kind of my passion was trying to educate, you know, my generation. And so I did, you know, start just working with clients my age and did, you know, seminars and workshops and, you know, tried, but obviously, you know, I'm one person trying to, you know, a small town community. So really it was the blog that kind of opened up that channel to try to reach more people just so they could better understand, you know, what's out there and how it works.
What are they responding to on your blog when you write about things? What do you find that people respond most to? Is it your stories about sort of being part of Operation Iraqi Freedom and being in the National Guard and how that sort of changed your perspective? Or is it more, you know, here I wasn't making much money and here's how I save. So is it personal? Is it sort of advice-driven stories?
Yeah, so, you know, a little bit of both. I think it's the personal stories, you know, of just sharing, you know, some of the mistakes I've made along the way, but also just sharing client experiences. And I know for me, you know, when I first started becoming a financial advisor when I was like in my mid to younger 20s, you know, the one meeting I remember that I had in like my first year was I was meeting with a couple that they were in their, I think, early 60s, you know, and Social Security was close but not there. And they literally had nothing saved for retirement. So, I mean, they weren't going to retire. They, you know, 70 if they were lucky. And I just remember, like, just meeting with them and just seeing how helpless they were. And, you know, I remember them saying to me, you know, I wish we would have saved earlier and I wish we would have saved more. And, you know, my parents could have told me that all day long and I never would have listened to them. But now here I am looking at this couple who I just met and realizing, my gosh, like, I don't want to be sitting in that seat, you know, telling some other financial advisor like the same story like 40 years from now. And that's really what kind of, that really inspired me and motivated me to change my life, but also, too, to try to pass that message on to, you know, other individuals my age.
It's kind of interesting. I had this conversation with maybe a few weeks ago about their retirement strategies. And I was saying to them, they said, oh, should we do this or should we do this or should we just save more? And I said, save more. That's what you should do. And she has young kids. She was in her 40s when she had her child. And she's like, but I'm thinking I'll be in my 60s. And if I don't have fun now, I'll, you know, by the time I can do this, I'm going to be in my 70s. And I said, look, you made the choice to have a child in your 40s. That was a choice you actively made. And this is what that means. And there's a lot of joy from it. Save now. I said, I'm not telling you not to have any fun. I'm not telling you not to go to the symphony. I'm just saying buy the cheap seats, right? and bank the $40 a seat difference, right? So for $10, you can go hear the symphony, or for $50, you can hear the symphony. And I'm just saying, go for the $10 seats and bank the $80 difference, because you're going to be happier knowing you have, you can still go to the symphony in your 70s, and you've now got money to do it. And truly, nobody has ever saved too much for retirement.
That's my quote. That's what I tell people all the time.
This is why we get along so well. But no, seriously, people say, well, I'll just have too much money. And I think to myself, nobody has too much money, because that becomes inheritances. That becomes the joy that you're able to take a trip or do a family trip or a multi-generational trip. That becomes the joy of being able to contribute to your grandchildren's college tuition, or that becomes the joy of buying a house for somebody who no longer can. You know, like one of your children, maybe they need some extra help. These are the joys that come with having too much money in retirement. And unfortunately for many people, they just underestimate things like what healthcare costs are going to be, and how it will, and how it is actually going to play out. And so I think people don't have a realistic scenario, but it's too hard to imagine, which is what your experience is.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so one of the things that you're doing that I think is great, and I want to give some little airtime to, you have set upon yourself this goal of getting $10 million in debt paid off in 90 days. Not your debt. You don't have $10 million in debt. But tell me a little bit about what you're trying to do and how all of us who are listening today can help.
Sure. So, you know, this past year, I found myself doing these mini blogging movements where I was able to recruit a lot of the top personal finance bloggers and also some major media sites, Equifax being included, to all write their posts on a different topic on a specific day. And we covered the Roth IRA movement, and that actually was that was spawned by me going to speak at my alma mater and talking to a class of graduating seniors, and not a single one of them knew what the Roth IRA was. And that's what started that one, because, like, you know, we're talking about the Gen X, and why not save? And here they're getting ready to join the working force and didn't even know what a Roth IRA was. And I didn't expect them to give me the Wikipedia definition. I was just hopeful that they could raise their hand and say, yeah, you know, I think I've heard of it, you know, but not a single one. So anyway, so we've been doing these movements, and I just felt the next logical one was debt. You know, I think we've all experienced debt, whether it be personal or through a family member or through a friend. And, you know, me personally, my father struggled with debt like his entire life. And even though he tried to teach me not to go into debt, you know, I started following some of those same principles while I was in college.
Did he go into debt because he didn't earn enough or because he had a spending problem?
I would say more the spending problem.
Okay.
Yeah, just did not have that self-control to know not to use a credit card. You know, he had a decent job, but he was buying things that he felt that he justified that he should be able to buy, you know, even though he couldn't pay cash.
Right.
So, and I know there's others that struggle with that, and it could be, you know, there'll be others, could be an income issue as well, but that's, you know, if you don't have the income, then you can't go buy the stuff that you can't afford. But, you know, so that's, the debt movement is just inspiring people to finally, you know, take charge of their own destiny, but also to join a community of others that are, you know, in a similar spot, you know, so other people they can relate with and relate to and share stories and connect and finally break some of these barriers that prevent us from just actually having control of ourselves.
It's amazing. So what are you going to do to get people all together? So this project starts, what, January 2nd?
January, you got it. So January 2nd is the big kickoff. I have a domain, debtmovement.com. Don't go there yet because the site's still being developed. But I partnered with a company called Ready for Zero, and they're basically just like a software company that they have a debt tracking program. It's a free application. You can just sync all your debts in there, and it shows you your debt progress as you're going along. And I've already been recruiting, you know, a lot of the top bloggers. I've already reached out to, like, Credit.com, MSN Money, LearnVest, obviously Equifax, Bankrate. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, big brands that are, you know, willing to jump on board. And the main thing that I want to accomplish is for the participants to share their story. You know, share their story of how they got to where they're at right now, you know, what's their plan of attack to get out of debt, and then also share along the way, you know, what are some of the pitfalls, you know, that are just the roadblocks that they run into. you know, as they're trying to go through this debt payoff process.
So what we're trying to do is get them to, everybody to sort of pay down debt in the 90-day period so that you can, because really everybody paying down a little bit turns out to be $10 million. It's a big number.
It is
really
a big number.
Well, I want people to be able to go and find out more. So you can follow Jeff on Facebook, J. Jeff Rose, at J. Jeff Rose, right?
That's my Twitter handle.
Twitter handle, and GoodFinancialSense, CENTS.com. And, of course, where I really want you to go, the Equifax Finance blog, where Jeff writes about retirement, saving strategies, and investing, all the things you need to know in order to have a solid retirement and have too much money in retirement. Jeff's got all the answers, and you can find him at Equifax Finance blog, blog.equifax.com. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, we'll talk again soon. I'm Elyse Glink. Stay tuned. When we come back, we are going to chat a little bit more about this and then meet some more of my friends. Next on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Back, everybody, to the Elyse Glink Show, live on Sundays here on News Talk WSB. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. I wanted to direct you to one of Jeff Rose's recent columns over at the Equifax Finance blog, which I think many people will find pretty helpful. It's called Retirement Planning for Freelancers and the Self-Employed. And what's interesting about this one, it's one of his, it was dated October 1st, is that so many people have lost their jobs and are now doing sort of freelance work, 1099 contract stuff. And you have to realize that you still can put money away. And putting money away, just incredibly important to keep up with it. Now, I know if the job's not paying much and you're making a lot less than you were, you might be using every single cent in order to just pay expenses. And I get that. I mean, life is very hard for some households right now. But if you're doing okay and you do have some of that extra money, you really might want to think about a Roth IRA or opening up a SEP IRA or even just putting into a conventional IRA. So check out Jeff's blog at Equifax Finance blog, blog.equifax.com, or just go to equifax.com, click on Finance blog, you'll see it, and it'll take you there so you can take a look at his work, which is excellent, by the way. And everything on the blog, really, what we try to do is find useful information that's going to help you do your life, your job, manage your money, do it all a little bit better with a little less craziness. So check it out today, the Equifax Finance blog. All right, coming up next, I've invited Liz Weston to come back on the show with us. I'm sorry, not Liz Weston. We have had Liz Weston. We had her a few weeks ago. But Liz Hanlon. Liz Hanlon is the CEO of UltimateResumes.com. She has an amazing bit of information. Some new stuff that's going on when people are hunting for jobs, and I knew you're going to want to take advantage. So stay tuned. I'm Elyse Glink, and you are listening to News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elyse Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elyse Glink Show. We're here on Sundays on News Talk WSB, noon to 2. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. We live tweet during the show. It's pretty cool. At Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. You should also go to our website, thinkglink.com, because if you're not signed up for the free weekly newsletter, you are really missing out on all kinds of deals. You will also be among the first to know when we have a new video, and we are posting new videos all the time. We've got this new Real Estate Minute thing going on, and we've got a real estate news brief that's going up, so really good stuff. You'll find out all about it at thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Liz Hanlon is back with us. You'll remember Liz. She is the resume queen, CEO of UltimateResumes.com. She has held positions with the Federal Reserve of Chicago, Deloitte & Touche, Netspend Corporation, She's directed recruiting. I mean, she just really understands what employers are looking for when they look at your resume. And so she started up this business, I don't even know how many years ago it is, but she's also written two ebooks, Interviewing Made Easy and The Ultimate Book of Thank You and Sympathy Notes, which is great. Liz, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Elise. Great to be here.
So, ultimateresumes.com, you see all the latest stuff going on. I've been reading that people are now thinking about dumbing down their resumes simply so that they, and de-inflating their credentials just to get a job. Are you seeing this? Are people seriously thinking about doing it?
People are very seriously doing it, not even thinking about doing it. I've had folks contact me, and when I started interviewing them, found out they had left all kinds of things off their resume that would make them more attractive to an employer. It's stunning.
Why are they doing that?
Well, in my opinion, they're doing it because they're not searching for a job in the right way. What I mean is, when I ask people who have dumbed down their resume, and we'll just call it that, why have you done this? The answer is invariably, I can't find a job. All right, how are you searching for a job? The answer almost 100% of the time is, well, I'm applying for jobs on the internet. I go to Monster, I go to Career Builder, I go to the Ladders. And then I'll ask, well, what else are you doing to search for a job? Are you leaving your house at all, or are you just sitting in front of the computer?
Are you leaving your house? Like there's one on the sidewalk outside. Of course, if you would just walk out that front door, you would see a job.
And you would see the job just lying there in the ground.
Waiting.
So, but they invariably say, no, I'm just, you know, point and click and hit send. And that's where they're going wrong, is looking for a job really hasn't changed very much in 25 years. When I got out of college, you looked in the time it was the newspaper, you looked for job ads, you went to the library, you looked up companies, and then you applied directly to companies. Send your cover letter, send your resume. And that's really what people need to be doing now. Make yourself a person, not just an email. And you're going to greatly increase your chances of getting a job. Not only that, you're going to get fewer rejections. You're going to get rejected, but you're not going to get the auto rejects, you know, every time you hit send.
You know, it's kind of interesting. We just hired somebody new at the company, and we're, you know, looking for a couple more people. And it's interesting to me, you know, we put a job ad out on LinkedIn. We were really specific about what we were looking at, and we got like 250 resumes for this job, of which four were relevant.
Right.
Four. So we weren't looking for anybody to dumb down their experience, but we had all kinds of people who were applying for stuff that they had no qualifications for. And that, to your point, I think is what where a big mistake happens, right? There's a disconnect between what you think you're looking for and then taking that experience that you have had and making it fit the job so that people actually think you're not crazy.
Well, you know, you just pointed out something that's a really important phenomenon. Because it's so easy to apply for jobs online, all you do is you literally push, apply for job, send in your resume. It's so easy that people think to themselves, hey, I'll apply for some extra jobs that I'm not quite qualified for just in case. And then sometimes they take the extra ridiculous step of adding a set of keywords on their resume that they believe apply to that job just to get the resume pulled.
Mm-hmm.
What that means on the back end is you have a recruiter, and let's say you have a really big company, something well-known like Deloitte, who is looking at an inbox with sometimes thousands and thousands of these emailed resumes, or whatever their system. There's all kinds of automated systems. Well, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think they're going to review every single one? Of course not. So when you're applying for jobs online, what you need to remember is your resume, even if it's a perfect fit, may never be seen simply because of the sheer volume that at the end of the day, a human's got to look at these things. The sheer volume of work. And on top of that, if your primary method for applying for jobs is online, your morale may take a big hit because, again, the more you apply, the more you do this online thing, the greater your chances of getting lots and lots of rejections. And I've talked to people who have started out their job search online, didn't do any of these old school tactics that really work well, and they were so depressed they could barely interview. So there's all kinds of reasons that you don't want to do this, you know, online applying as your primary method of looking for a job, and why you don't need to dumb down your resume to find a job.
So that's what you're telling people. The message you're saying is you don't really need to dumb it down. You need to change what you're doing so that people, you know, you're actually looking in the right place. You're fishing in a you're fishing in the right well, is what you're trying to say.
Exactly.
To people.
You need to change the way you're fishing. You need to create a target list of companies you're interested in working for. If you're at a senior level, you want to create a list of decision makers who work in the company that you might want to meet. If you're a chief financial officer, invite the CEO to lunch. This works surprisingly well, and I know you know this. It's amazing who will return your call if you just pick up the phone and call them. Hey, that's a lost art. People don't do that anymore.
Well, nobody calls. Like, I mean, I go all day. In fact, it was interesting. Somebody actually called our office today, or Friday, and I've watched the phone ring, and I'm, like, waiting for somebody to pick it up. I see the phone is ringing. I'm in a meeting, and the phone rings and rings and rings and rings and rings. Guy leaves a message. I'm like, there are 8 people in the office. Nobody's available to pick up the phone. Somebody actually called us. It was the first time it rang all day.
They forgot to pick up. They forgot how to pick up the phone.
Forgot how to pick up. It's a lost art. This is an even loster art than the art of not making a phone call, I guess.
Well, I think individual, like, interpersonal communication, like going out and meeting somebody for a cup of coffee, sending in an actual paper resume, going to talk to a human being, getting out of your house to network and meet with people, is becoming a lost art. The Internet is the world's greatest gift in terms of research. You can find out anything about anybody and any company. So it gives you a tremendous position of power over, say, when I came out of college and when you graduated college, you know, you had to go to the library, you had to look up annual reports. That's all online, so you can do it at home. But
people would have, I mean, if somebody wanted to find out about me, I mean, geez, there's, I think, just about everything. We have a Facebook page where there's a Twitter feed you can follow. There's thinklink.com. There's thinklinkpublishing.com. There's LinkedIn. There's a million ways to find out information about us.
Exactly. I mean, first of all, you could never go in the witness protection program, Elise, just in case.
That's good to know.
Visible. Yeah, you're too visible. But yeah, you're right. It's the best way to research anything and anyone. But it is not the best way to make a contact that might land you a job, because people hire people. They don't hire emails. And that doesn't mean that you can't email people. It doesn't mean you can't do some online applications. But don't let that be your primary, tactic. Or you're going to set yourself up for failure, and you may feel like, hey, I need to dumb myself down, but really you're solving the wrong problem. The problem is you're not searching for a job in the right way. So
it's sort of interesting. I mean, because every time we have you on, I learn something new about the whole job search, and it reminds me of things that drive me crazy as an employer looking for new people. So one of my pet peeves is that with all this information that's available about our company, we have candidates who actually do have a good enough resume, and they come in and they don't know anything about what we do. They have not taken the time to actually look at any of our 10 websites, watch any of our videos off of YouTube, nothing. So they come in and I'll say, so how do you think you could help our company, and how do you think what do you want to learn from us, and what do we do actually? I just sort of ask it like that now. And that's like it's a deal killer for me. If they don't tell me what I do pretty close to it, I mean, it's complicated, but some sort of resemblance. If they haven't made me understand that they've actually been to the website or one or more than one, the interview's over within 5 minutes.
You know what's funny to me about that? If you talk to young people in their 20s and you talk to them about, and it's a little bit different topic, but it's going to link, talk to them about dating, they'll tell you that before they go on a date with somebody, they check out their Facebook page, they Google them, just to find out information. Isn't it amazing that 20-somethings will go to that length to find out about somebody they're just going on a date with, and grown adults who've had careers don't do just a little bit of research about a company they're going to interview with? Because at the end of the day, you're going to get hired because you solve a problem for someone. So when someone comes in to interview with Elise Glenk, they should know who you are. They should know what books you've written. They should know how they can add value to the company. They should have some kind of an answer to that, even if it's not the perfect answer, because otherwise you're unimpressed that they haven't bothered to find out information about you that's so easily accessible. It's a little bit insulting when they do that.
Well, it's just like, are you kidding me, really? So what it tells me as an employer, which is sort of interesting, is it communicates to me, whether they mean this or not, I'm sure they don't, but it makes me feel like if you don't take enough time to do this before you've shown up, let's say I hire you and now give you an assignment, are you going to kind of skate through that too? And not take the time to really do the research that's needed and think about it in the right way? Is that how you're going to handle it? Or are you actually going to dig in and really do something valuable? So it communicates something to the employer, I think, that you haven't taken that time. That makes them think, at least it makes me think, well, when you're actually in my office and I'm actually paying you, what kind of an employer are you going to be?
You make an excellent point. If you can't take the time to research a potential employer, a place where you're going to spend roughly 50% of your time or more, I mean, how can you be trusted to be thorough in the job? That's exactly how I'd interpret it. And I would tell you that none of the people who have come in to talk to you are my clients, or they would have been browbeaten into understanding this.
I'm sure that's true. The other thing that I think is sort of, that I want to just sort of point out, something that you had, and then we'll take a quick break and come back, is this idea that, you know, you go in for a date, right? Somebody you might want to spend your life with, and you do all this research. Well, when you go into a company, I want you... It's not like it's a marriage, because that sounds a little weird, but I want you to have a long-term relationship with us. You know, I talked to somebody today, and I said, hey, I'm hoping you'll stay 5 or 7 years. Like, I'm sure this won't be the job you die in, but because you're like in your early 20s. But this is something that I want you to consider as a long-term commitment, and we will have a path for you to grow. Like, it's not just what it is. And so what I'm looking for is this idea that somebody actually can... you know, think about us as being a future, not just a today.
Well, the other piece of that is there have been numerous studies, and you may have read some yourself, that indicate that the biggest determinant of success, an employee's success or failure in a company, is cultural fit. Do you, the employee, fit with that culture, the stated and unstated aspects of the day-to-day work? So it behooves employees or potential employees to really do their homework about an employer, not just function, but also go to websites like Glassdoor.com, The Vault, Wet Feet. These are all websites that have great information from former or current employees about the culture of the company, about what it's really like to work there, about integrity and values, and all the things that are going to be super meaningful in your day-to-day work.
Such a great suggestion. Let's take a quick break. I want to come back and finish up with this because, as always, so much great information. Liz Handlin is the CEO of UltimateResumes.com. She's been a guest on the show a number of times. She's written a bunch of e-books. Stay tuned. We're going to have some quick tips for you if you're looking for a job when we come back. I'm Elise Glink. This is News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. We're talking with Liz Handlin about getting a job, experiences I've had as an employer, and she's had guiding people with her resume, UltimateResumes.com. She's written a bunch of e-books. They're amazing. And as you've been listening to this conversation, it makes me want to go out and get a job. All right, Liz, when you have somebody who's in maybe the second or third level of interviewing, you were just starting to talk about this idea of a 30-day plan or a 30-day outlook. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is take the research that you should be doing about the company and the culture to the next level. So when you go in to meet with a company, if you want to impress the employer, you need to understand what the company does, who the key players are, how you could add value. But then I also recommend to my client that as they approach the latter stages of the interview process, to start to think about how they would approach the job, the first 30 days on the job. And I say, create a first 30 days business plan. You don't have to hand it to them. In fact, I recommend you don't. But just kind of have it in your back pocket so that you can talk to that if you reach a point in the interview process where you want to sound really serious and say, hey, let me tell you how I would hit the ground running. It's a very impressive way to show knowledge of the company and that you're really serious about joining this company and adding value.
I really think that adding value thing is so key. I mean, just today we had somebody else in for an interview, and she asked smart questions, but what she really did was say, well, here's what I would do over the next 30, 60, 90 days. She had it all kind of mapped out in her head, and she said, and then she asked me a question I thought was really good. She said, why are you looking to hire for this position?
Excellent question.
And I thought, and I said, because I have more work than I know what to do with at the moment. And so she laughed, and it was all pretty good, you know, and this girl is also going to get a call back. Liz, where can, I'm sending people to UltimateResumes.com. Do you have a Twitter handle as well?
I do. It's Liz H, L-I-Z, capital H. Liz Handlin, at Twitter. And I don't Twitter that much, but I have a LinkedIn profile. I post comments there and my website. And there's a blog on my website as well, too.
All right. Well, everybody should tap into that and read it. Liz, thanks so much for being with us. We're going to have you back again soon. Until everybody's employed in Georgia, we're going to keep having you back.
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
All right. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be back in a flash with more on the Elise Glink Show here on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show here on News Talk WSB. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. I am at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Don't forget to sign up for the free weekly newsletter and check out the Equifax Finance blog for all things related to credit and your money. Great free information. You'll find me there as well. So joining us on the line right now is Amy Cruz Cutts. Amy is the chief economist for Equifax, but I have known her for a very long time. Not that long, but long enough, more than a decade, because she used to be the deputy chief economist for Freddie Mac. And we met over, I have to say, Amy, it was over drinks maybe, or some panel discussion that we were both sitting on, or maybe I was moderating and you came to be on it. But I remember sitting so many of these conferences with you talking about the economy and how the worlds of credit and mortgage all played together.
That's your memory is very good.
There have been umpteen panels, as we like to say.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I wanted to invite you on now. You're in the position of the head honcho over there for economy at Equifax, and you're in a position to really see so much of what's going on with consumers. And we talk about this all the time. You know, getting credit is hard, maintaining it, raising it, and a lot of people have seen it fall dramatically with this great recession. And I understand that you've been working on this idea of sort of a new and different consumer when it comes to credit and how they're spending money. What are you seeing going on out there?
Well, Elise, you know, if you think back to when you took economics in college a while ago, we learned something. You know, typically we talk about the representative agent, which is kind of your average consumer, right, sort of, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
And what we're seeing, I think I'm going to say in the data today kind of speaks to that average or representative consumer. And I fully recognize that people's lives are complicated. So, but, you know, what I'm looking at is aggregate trends. And starting about 2 years ago, maybe 18 months ago, we started to see a fundamental change in the numbers that indicates we may be in a new paradigm of what I'm going to call the disciplined consumer.
And when you say you saw a change in the numbers, what was it? Because I'm sure you look at pages and pages and pages of, you know, numbers every day. What did you start to see exactly?
So let's talk about credit cards to start off with. These are cards issued by banks. So I'm not talking about retail cards that might come through Macy's or something like that. And in that, starting at about middle of 2010, we saw a jump up in the monthly amount that borrowers send in on their credit card balances.
And you mean above the minimum? So people normally send the minimum or they pay the whole thing off, but they usually don't pay above the minimum?
Right. And so what we're seeing here is that consumers are paying more than the minimum. More and more consumers are paying more than the minimum. And that's been steadily climbing for the past 2.5 years.
Okay.
So that's one thing.
And how much are they paying? Is it significant?
Well, in our data, I mean, the numbers sound small, but in aggregate, it's actually pretty big. That the numbers here, this is what we call the payment ratio, which is the monthly payment to outstanding balances, has climbed from a low of 4%. Now it's up to about 4.7%.
Okay.
It seems small, but when I talk to my friends in the banking, you know, who work for these large banks that have large portfolios, they're saying that they're seeing the same trend, but the numbers are even bigger in their portfolios. So that means that consumers are paying 10 or 15% of the balances each
okay.
month.
That is big.
Yeah, and it's consistent. Whenever I talk to people at these institutions, they say, oh, yeah, we're seeing that too. So it's not something transitory. It's not something being, you know, washed out because of one institution. This is consistent across the board.
So is it that people are thinking, I want to, I'll use the fancy term, deleverage. I want to get rid of some of my debt. Or are they thinking, I have extra money, I'm just going to throw it at it?
You know, I have no way of knowing. I only get to look at the distilled numbers at
okay.
the end. But I think it may be a combination of, you know, that with the CARD Act, there were new disclosures that had to come out. So that if you look at the monthly statements from a credit card company now, it not only has the, you know, fine print disclosures, but it has a big box and big font that says, if you only pay the minimum, this is how long it takes you to pay off this month's debt.
So that's got to be scary for most people because the number's probably like 24 years.
Well, it's not even the number of years. It's, you know, to me, it's a little bit like when you do your mortgage documents, too. It always says, you know, how much it's going to cost you, the total.
Yep.
And so, you know, if you buy a $150 sweater thinking you got a great deal, but it by the time you pay all the interest and pay it off in 4 years, it costs you $350, probably wasn't such a good deal. So I think maybe consumers are looking at those boxes and realizing that they've got to do more than the $35 payment. They've got to step it up. And so is that the response? I don't know, but it certainly coincides with the timing. But the numbers keep increasing. So if it was just sort of the one-time level adjustment, that'd be one thing, but it's continuing every month to go up.
Hmm.
So I think it's a new paradigm. Another thing that's happening, consistent with this, again in bank cards, is banks are issuing more cards. Economy's improving a little bit. They're opening the door slightly to credit. It's kind of cracked open at the moment. So they're issuing more cards. The cards they're issuing have higher credit limits by about $1,000. So if you get a new card today, it's, you know, going to be a little more attractive than the one maybe that you got in the middle of the recession. But consumers aren't using it. They're tucking them in drawers.
Really?
Utilization rates continue to fall.
What do you think is behind that? Because, you know, when we are on the show, we hear from people who are using their credit cards to buy gas and groceries and all sort of the basic necessities of life.
Right. And I think, you know, that's certainly true. But I think what's happening is that people who are eligible for new credit, who maybe had a home equity line of credit that was cut or, you know, completely closed, can't get home equity lines anymore because there's no equity to borrow against.
Exactly.
So they're taking out cards as kind of that insurance factor.
So
or
they
maybe
just
they're going to put tuition on it later. But
maybe. But they want to know. They want to know that there's something in their back pocket in case it goes bad again. There's another $5,000 they can tap or something, maybe.
Exactly. And certainly issuers, are trying to get the right card offer to the right person of, you know, are you a points person or are you a low interest rate person, those kinds of things. I'm starting to see more and more marketing that way. But in terms of total mailings, the banks are not being aggressive in sending out solicitations. So this is really being driven sort of, I think, you know, obviously banks are very prudent right now, but consumers, too, seem to be behaving in a way of the demand for credit is for the access, not so much to the utilization.
So let's say that we move from credit cards. What are you seeing in terms of debt, other kinds of debt, like car loans? We've got student loans up the wazoo for sure. Mortgages.
Okay, so student loans are hard to evaluate because they're the only credit we do that's both unsecured and not underwritten.
Right.
Right, if you're a college student and you get accredited university, you can get a loan. They send it to the university and it's done. So that one's always difficult because there's no credit underwriting with it. With auto loans, the average age of a car on the road today is over 11 years. It's the longest time we've driven our cars since they started keeping those statistics. And there's a huge pent-up demand for new cars. Even if we all go out and buy new cars, you know, at a much more rapid rate than we are today, we still have to buy about another 2 million units per year to be at where we were before the recession.
Wow.
And then think of all those cars that we didn't buy in the intermediate term, and that's why these cars are so old today.
How old is your car? Mine is 10 years.
Well, my car was 11 years, and...
don't you like to be average?
My new car is 6 months old.
So there you go. All right. So you went out there and supported the economy. Thank you very much.
I did. Mostly because I was looking at big repair bills, so I said
right.
To get rid of it. But yes, I'm that 11-year-old car, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of pent-up demand, and what we're seeing there is, you know, if you look at something like Ford's earnings statements, we're in earnings season again, you know, we're going to see some more statements here. The last two from Ford, I really noticed that they said, hey, unit sales are gangbusters. We're doing great. Things are awesome. Then you look at the dollar volumes, and they're much smaller. So people are not buying the giant SUVs. They're buying the much more attractively priced midsize and lower sedans.
So they're spending less there as well. They're taking on less debt. What about the loans that people take out for cars? Are they also doing, you know, for a while I was writing about 7-year car loans and 10-year car loans. Are they back down to 5-, 4-, and 3-year loans?
That's certainly the offers that are going out, but in our data we have a very difficult time discerning that. We kind of know the balances, but we don't know the conditions under which the loans were granted.
We'll have to look. I shall have to do a little extra research,
research. Yeah. Let me talk for a minute about mortgages, because that's another pretty interesting side. Freddie Mac comes out every quarter with a nice report that talks about refinancings. And one of the statistics they have is the share of loans that are cash-in refinances. We all know cash-outs, right, when you take more than you owed before. Cash-ins are where you pay down a little extra and lower the balance when you refinance. They're looking at the record high percentage of refinancings that are putting money in.
So people are trying to refinance and they're underwater and they're trying to buy that down.
I don't even think they're underwater. I think they look at maybe you're on the cusp of jumbo land.
Well, they have to be at 20% equity to not have to pay private mortgage insurance. And PMI
right.
has gotten so expensive because those companies all took multi-billion dollar baths.
Right. So on that level, if you can get it down to 80, you can certainly avoid mortgage insurance. If you can get it down to 75, you get best pricing.
Right.
Okay. And if you're maybe $3,000 or $10,000 away from that limit, that might be a good thing to do. Underwater is a little tougher, especially with the HARP stuff that's available. I don't know that you get a big benefit from that. But, you know, people choose to do what they choose to do.
Right.
On that. We're also seeing a large number of people just pay down the debt. I'm done with mortgages. Don't want it anymore.
Do you think that this idea of the disciplined consumer, the person who's not going to take out excessive loans, is maybe going to have credit in their hip pocket but not use it, is not going to take out the biggest mortgage, is not going to buy the most expensive car that they could, is this a permanent change?
It's always hard to talk about permanence, right? I mean,
well, I know we're not even really out of this recession, although
right.
I know we are, but we're not. So.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's the numbers and there's the reality, right? When I think about it, it certainly is. We're very much like what happens when somebody gets a cardiac scare, right? They suddenly become very good at eating fruits and vegetables and a lot less fried stuff, right?
Right.
And we stick to the carrots and broccoli diet for a while, but then carrots and broccoli get boring. And I don't know whether this is kind of a permanent change and that people are really deciding to live more within their means and understand that the American dream is theirs, but you got to earn it step by step. Start with starter homes, not mm-hmm. mansions, you know, that kind of logic. Or whether this is temporary, but, you know, it's been going on now for 2 years-ish, and the behavior doesn't seem to be stalling out. And I realize banks are very picky about who they lend credit to, but, you know, once you've lent it, they want to do what they want. So, and we're seeing, like I say, we're seeing this in small business. Small businesses are taking out credit cards, not using them.
It's amazing. We are on the phone with Amy Cruz Cutts. She's the chief economist of Equifax, and I've known her for years, where she used to be the deputy chief economist over at Freddie Mac, and so somebody who's really able to look at the numbers and give us a sense of how things are changing, and they certainly are. Amy, can you stick around for a minute or two?
Sure.
All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little bit more with Amy Cruz Cutts about the economy and this new idea of the disciplined consumer. And if you have thoughts about that, go to the thinkglink.com blog. We'll have Amy's information and all the other information from everybody we've talked to today, and leave your thoughts there. I'm Elise Glink. This is News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM. News Talk WSB.
Everybody to the Elise Glink Show. We have been talking with Amy Cruz Cutts. She's the chief economist of Equifax. We're going to start to feature her work on the Equifax Finance blog. There, Amy, I said it. You're going to have to do it now.
All right.
So you'll be able to get some of her insights in our credit blog, and there's just so much there. We've been talking about credit, the nature of credit, and how Amy is seeing this emergence of a disciplined consumer. So congratulations, everybody listening. You're paying your bills, and more than you should, or rather, more than you have to. When it comes to mortgages, Amy, or delinquencies, we were talking a little bit about that just during the break. Where are you seeing things, and how does that fit into your sort of premise, the paradigm?
Okay. Well, with respect to the other piece that we didn't talk about is the, just like we're seeing in credit cards, we're seeing consumers curtail their debt. So if your mortgage payment is $2,000, maybe it was $2,200 before you refinanced, we're seeing consumers send in $2,100 or the full $2,200. So they're adding that extra $100 or $200 they saved on their refinance back into paying down the principal. So that 30-year loan becomes more like a 28 or a 25-year loan. And again, I think it has to do with people looking at that money. They were used to sending in $2,200. It's if they don't change their their behavior. They can pay down that loan even faster, but it doesn't hurt, right, the way it would if you stepped up that amount. So all of these, to me, are signs that consumers have fundamentally changed their behaviors. Now, of course, we have the problem of there were the folks who never should have gotten some of these loans in the first place that really kind of blew up earlier in the financial crisis that kind of led to a lot of these problems. But now we're certainly seeing signs that the recession is catching up with people, right? Bad things happening to good people who made previously pretty wise decisions, but job losses and you know, life has catched up to them. And that's part of what we're seeing now in the delinquencies in New York and New Jersey and some of these states that weren't really affected by the financial crisis, but now, especially because they have judicial foreclosure processes, they're being very slow to recover. Right. Even though the economy is catching up. Just to kind of put in context, right now in Florida, it's 1,000 days between the due date of the last time they made a payment, the last payment they made, and when they lose the home to a foreclosure auction.
3 years.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Three years. And I know that's probably the longest right now, but there are, I mean, New York was also really long.
Correct.
I think for a while as well.
Well, worse in Florida is that you know, they had to lay off sheriffs and processors in the courts because they simply don't have the tax base now to support it all. You know, in the state where I live here in Virginia, by statute, they can have my house in 38 days. So, you know, it's the kind of the Virginia rocket docket, but foreclosures here are even taking in excess of 3 years, 300 days, simply because of the policies that the banks have put in place.
Amy Cruz-Cutts is the chief economist of Equifax, and you can find her soon, very, very soon, at the Equifax Finance blog. Amy, thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure.
We will have you back again soon. I'm Elise Glenk. You're hearing the music. That means time is up. At least I think you're hearing the music. I'm hearing the music. Anyway, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of the Elise Glenk Show. Have a great week, everybody. You're listening to News Talk WSB.